This week on Vaticano, meet some of the female leaders in the Vatican. Learn about the preparations the Diocese of Rome is making for the Jubilee of Teenagers. And discover one of the oldest churches in Rome, the Church of the Pilgrim. Vaticano starts now. Over the weekend, the Order of Malta celebrated the Jubilee of Grand Priors, Regents, and Presidents of National Associations. The Sovereign Order united its international leaders together in Rome, using this opportunity to host a conference discussing the impact of ongoing humanitarian initiatives and strengthening relations among the 120 countries that are part of the Order. One of the humanitarian topics discussed was the necessity to move with the times and the importance in adapting economically and industrially to new technologies. The Grand Chancellor supports the idea of the Order of Malta embracing the digital age with the opportunity to modernize the outlook their society has on the future.
In the future of the Order of Malta lies the fact that, not betraying any of its traditions, it must enter the third millennium. Entering the third millennium means connecting with a new leading class. And in the third millennium, we need to take technologies into account because technologies will be of great use to us. They are extremely useful. For example, think of artificial intelligence. It can help us when there are emergencies. There are so many things that can be done today because of these tools. But there too, you have to equip yourself.
The weekend concluded with the Sovereign Order processing through the Holy Door at the Papal Basilica of St. Mary Major, praying for the health of Pope Francis and celebrating Mass led by Cardinal Gianfranco Ghirlanda, who was appointed Cardinal Patron of the Order of Malta by the Holy Father in 2023. At the end of the Mass, the Cardinal, together with the Grand Commander and Grand Master, advanced in procession to the relic altar of the Holy Crib.
My visit is evidence that we stand together to defend both.
On Friday, February the 28th, the diocesan phase closed for the beatification of former Prime Minister of Italy, Alcide De Gasperi. The ceremony took place at the Lateran Palace in Rome, marking a crucial step in the process of recognizing his virtues. Alcide De Gasperi, Italy's first prime minister after World War II, was a statesman deeply rooted in his Catholic faith. A key figure in the post-war reconstruction of Italy, he played a central role in Italy's economic recovery, aided by American support through international assistance programs. His leadership helped guide the nation through its most challenging years, and his unwavering commitment to Christian values influenced his approach to politics, advocating for peace, unity, and social justice.
Alcide De Gasperi is certainly an extraordinary figure. Not only because of his charisma, not only because of the strength of his faith, but above all, because of his ability to read the times. Obviously, after the Second World War, Italy was a defeated, destroyed country, and he managed to find a way to lift it up and bring it to the economic boom of the late 1950s and early 1960s. So, when we think of him, we think of a figure who had the merit and the ability to turn a particularly difficult, complicated moment into an opportunity for the country's rebirth.
The closing of the diocesan phase paves the way for the next steps in the canonization process, with the documentation now set to be sent to the Vatican's Congregation for the Causes of Saints. If the process progresses positively, De Gasperi could be recognized as venerable, bringing him one step closer to beatification.
Hello and welcome to this week's Vaticano Updates, the most important news from the Holy Father and the Vatican. While still in the hospital, Pope Francis addressed what he called a planetary crisis in his message to the Pontifical Academy for Life. The Academy held a meeting of scientists, theologians, and historians at the Vatican. Dramatically titled The End of the World? Participants discussed crises, responsibilities, and also reasons for hope. In his address, the Holy Father spoke of many crises, including climate and technological change. Utilitarian deregulation and global neoliberalism would impose a law of the strongest. And further, we should not expect to be saved by new technologies, nor by international bodies, which have progressively become irrelevant, wrote Pope Francis. However, he did emphasize the fundamental attitude of hope and the important aspect of community for the common good of humanity. We stay with the Vatican's Academy for Life. The organization has awarded Sister Justina Olya Holubets the 2025 Garden of Life Award. The Ukrainian religious sister received the award for her work leading a perinatal hospice for parents who receive a life-ending or life-limiting diagnosis for their preborn children. Perinatal Hospice Imprint of Life was established in Lviv in 2017 to accompany parents who face severe diagnoses while the child is still in the womb. Migrants, missionaries of hope. This year, the Church will celebrate the World Day of Migrants and Refugees on October the 4th and the 5th, and it will coincide with a two-day celebration of the Jubilee of Migrants and the Missionary World. Pope Francis wants to highlight the courage and tenacity of migrants and refugees who, and I quote, daily bear witness to their hope for the future despite the difficulties. This year, the annual Lenten retreat will take place in the Vatican in spiritual communion with Pope Francis. The theme of the retreat is the hope of eternal life. During the week, the papal preacher, Father Roberto Pasolini, will give 10 spiritual reflections to cardinals and other employees of the Vatican. Pope Francis invited the faithful to pray for families in crisis during the month of March. In his message, the Holy Father acknowledged that many families are wounded and suggested pardoning one another always renews the family. The images and audio for the published video for the prayer intentions were prepared prior to the Pope's hospitalization. Please join us also in praying for Pope Francis while he's still in the hospital. But thank you so much for watching this week's Vaticano Updates in Rome. Andreas Tonhauser for EWTN Vaticano.
In just a few moments, we'll be back with a closer look at some of the female leaders at the Vatican. Just a week before he was admitted to the Gemelli Hospital, the Holy Father underscored in an interview that opening the work in the Curia to women is important.
It definitely makes us proud. We also have the weight of what we do. Why? Because we are in a mission, in a common project, which is service to the Universal Church and service to the Holy Father.
Giulia Culurà has been working as an archivist in various Vatican departments since 2010. Initially in the Propaganda Fide, then in the Pontifical Council of Corunum, and for the last 2.5 years in the Dicastery for Culture and Education.
Carte di Stato, documenti ad alto.
These are state documents, documents with a high historical content, unique and unrepeatable. And it's really exciting for me to work here and to be able to read and touch these documents, the decisive stages in the life of the entire church.
Women have always played an important role in the church. Pope Francis has made it a point of his pontificate to also appoint women into leadership roles inside the Vatican.
La Chiesa è donna.
When 28 years ago, I was appointed in the Vatican Library, I was the third woman to work in the Vatican Library. And when I left the Vatican Library 20 years after, the half of the staff was already women.
In the Vatican City-State, the presence of women over the past decade has increased significantly to 1,165 female collaborators. Never before has the number of female employees and their representation within the total staff been so high. In January of 2017, an Italian art historian, Barbara Iatta, was appointed by Pope Francis as the director of the Vatican Museums, the highest-ranking lay post for a woman in the Vatican to date.
When once after 2 years I was in Mexico City, I was lecturing in Catholic University of Mexico City, and after my conference, two students came to me and they said to me, "I want to shake your hands, I want to know you, because for us, you are an example. You are a mother, a woman, a wife, but you also follow your passion and you have an apical role in probably the best museum in the world." And there I said, oh, I can be an example for young students, for young girls. And so that's how I realized the importance of my appointment and the incredible and amazing choice that Pope Francis made for me.
During Pope Francis's pontificate, the growth of the number of women employees has been quite remarkable, growing from 19 to 24% of the 4,000 total employees. The percentage of those working for the Roman Curia is even higher, reaching 26%. Five women have held the rank of undersecretary and one that of secretary of a department. The General Secretariat for the Synod of Bishops, for example, has a female undersecretary, Sister Nathalie Becard.
Well, I would say first it was really a surprise. What it first means, you know, when you receive a call from Pope Francis, it's an appointment from Pope Francis, so it means for me a call of the Church, a call of God.
Experience synodale.
Sister Nathalie, who has held her role since 2021, is convinced that in the midst of differences between men and women, a profound dialogue can arise that will simply enrich the mutual collaboration.
Women bring a kind of alterity, diversity. So I always highlight, that has been my experience through all my pastoral experience, when you have team, especially leadership team with men and women, with also the diversity of vocations, you are always better because you cross-read the questions and you take better decisions when you don't have only one lens to look at the things.
Sister Simona Brambilla is the first woman ever to head a dicastery, an entire Vatican department. She was appointed in January as prefect of the Dicastery for Institutes of Consecrated Life. But she's not the only woman religious entrusted with a lot of power in the Vatican. From March the 1st, Sister Raffaella Petrini became the president of the governorate of Vatican City-State. The appointment of Sister Petrini represents a new approach to the governance of the Holy See and confirms the pontiff's openness to female leadership roles.
There is a new way of integrating ourselves into the Catholic Church. And in this new way, we can sincerely and freely express our professionalism, our working qualities, our inclinations, our abilities. And it is precisely in this new advent that the role of Pope Francis is crucial.
Questo nuovo avvento è stato fondamentale il ruolo di Papa Francesco.
Rome is gearing up for the Jubilee of Teenagers, scheduled for the end of April, culminating in the canonization of Carlo Acutis, the first millennial saint. Thousands of young pilgrims will flood the city, with Father Alfredo Tedesco, the Diocese of Rome's youth pastoral director, along with his team, making sure that they all feel at home. Parishes are mobilizing, volunteers are stepping up, and Roman families are opening their homes to host them. But how can the Church truly connect with today's youth? Hannah Brockhaus, EWTN's senior Vatican correspondent, sat down with Father Tedesco to find out.
Father Alfredo Tedesco, what is the Diocese of Rome doing for the Jubilee of Teenagers in April?
Chiaramente la diocesi di Roma è la diocesi del Papa.
Clearly, the Diocese of Rome is the Pope's diocese, and therefore the host diocese for the Jubilee of Youth event. We know that the Jubilee will take place from April 25th to April 27th, and will culminate in the canonization of Blessed Carlo Acutis. In the meantime, the Diocese of Rome is experimenting with the Ministry of Welcome. Our parish communities are organizing themselves both through the structures of reception, the shelters, but also through, we could say, the people, the communities, who are organizing the voluntary service of welcoming young people into our communities.
Per accogliere gli adolescenti nelle nostre comunità.
You are the person in charge of the office for youth ministry in the Diocese of Rome. What does that entail exactly?
Ci preoccupiamo di promuovere proprio il Vangelo, di portare il Vangelo.
In the Diocese of Rome, we try to promote the gospel with all the particularities that this age group needs anyway. And we do it through the network of our parish communities. But we also do it thinking of all those children whom we are not able to reach, even those who, for their own reasons, do not come to church. And so, it's also about experimenting with the animation of the pastoral life for the youth of our diocese.
What is the spiritual reality right now for Italian teens and young people?
Noi abbiamo tanti luoghi comuni sui giovani, sugli adolescenti.
We have so many stereotypes about young people. For example, we think that the fact that they don't go to church means that they are not interested in spirituality, in faith, in the Christian religion, but also in the religious phenomenon in general. Actually, from what we know, I feel that they have a great desire. Definitely a lot of questions. A desire for God. Deep, sincere, authentic, just not expressed in the way we're used to. I'm talking about us adults.
Are there any particular challenges in this moment to reaching young people and to encouraging them to participate greater in their faith, to answer this desire?
The Office of Youth Ministry, the initiatives that we have done, having started right in the COVID period of the pandemic, I started this service on September 1st, 2020. I couldn't help but confront, reflect with the digital phenomenon. And there was the opportunity, our offices know it well, to try to experiment in this field, but with a particularity, asking young people to help be apostles for other young people in the digital context. The Pope calls them digital missionaries, and this is true. That is a real missionary country, a continent, the digital world, where we have to learn a language, the language of this context, and where the protagonists, or rather co-responsible, that is, those who share this responsibility with us, are the young people themselves.
In fact, I had another question about this protagonism of youth that Pope Francis calls it, right? And so you gave me one example, but I don't know if you have other examples of how you are letting youth also lead and not only be the subjects, but or be the objects, but be the subjects of the story too.
La diocesi di Roma ragiona in questo modo.
The Diocese of Rome sees it this way, very concretely. In the team, let's say, in the team for youth ministry of the diocese, I wanted there to be both adults, because it's good that there are, and also less adults. In Italian will be young adults, which are families, consecrated, and so on. But I, at the decision-making level, always want to hear their opinion. Saint Benedict says, when in doubt, listen to the young person. I've tried to make this rule fundamental for me, necessary, so that I don't think of them only when decisions are already taken, but in the process of making decisions, always asking them for their word, which is often the last one. That is, where we adults can't reach, their freshness has led me concretely to always do the right thing.
Right now we're in the Jubilee of Hope. So I wanted to ask, what gives you hope for the future of the church and for the future of young people right now?
Per me, I giovani.
To me, young people are hope, to look at them, to prepare them, to work with them, to be with them, gives me so much joy and hope, but it also gives me reason to look to the future with so much faith.
We'll be back after a short break with a special look at the Church of the Pilgrim, one of the oldest churches on Vatican Hill. This is one of the most ancient churches on the Vatican Hill. It was first mentioned, and thus already existed, at the time of the pontificate of Pope St. Leo III at the end of the 8th century. According to what we can read in the Liber Pontificalis, the Pope donated a silver lamp to this little church, located next to St. Peter's Basilica.
La prima data di cui si parla.
The first date is in 795, because Leo III, at that time, entrusted it to the care of some priests.
Dei sacerdoti.
It's a very small church, and originally it was called St. Peregrine at the Naumachia. What was a Naumachia? Naumachia was an ancient stadium where the Romans used to organize naval battles, and apparently in ancient times there used to be a Naumachia in that particular area.
The ancient tradition associates the following name with Charlemagne in the year 800.
It changed its name to the Church of St. Peregrine when, in the 9th century, during the coronation of Charlemagne, the church received the relics of the Bishop of Auxerre, St. Peregrine.
He was a Roman priest, missionary, and then bishop, who died as a martyr in a persecution in the 4th century. At that point, the chapel became the Church of St. Peregrine, and it was part of a larger complex, like others that sprang up around St. Peter's.
The first date mentioned is in 795, because Leo III, at that time, entrusted it to the care of some priests.
The location of the church is unique and refers to the centuries-old history of pilgrimage. It is to be found on the street called Via del Pellegrino, the Way of the Pilgrim. The pilgrims used to walk along this pathway, arriving to St. Peter's Basilica, situated just 200 meters from here.
They could find shelter nearby the church, and if unfortunately this the Vatican was, or Rome was their final destination, this was also the place where they could get buried.
Because sometimes pilgrims arrived exhausted and were therefore buried in this cemetery.
Already in the Middle Ages, thousands of people from Northern Europe were traveling to Rome along this route. It was actually the last church before they entered St. Peter's Basilica, and it was at the same time the very last stretch of the Via Francigena, the famous pilgrim way that led the Romae, the pilgrims from Northern Europe, ad limina apostolorum, to the tomb of St. Peter.
The Via Francigena originates from the description made by the first to trace this route, Archbishop Cydric of Canterbury, who, before the year 1000, described this road upon his return from Rome.
The church, after having been a place of welcome and prayer for ancient pilgrims, had become the property of the Vatican chapter. In 1657, Pope Alexander VII officially granted it to the Pontifical Swiss Guard Corps, which had already been celebrating there for some years.
Le guardie svizzere l'hanno.
The Swiss Guards kept it and used it as their chapel until 1977.
The walls are still decorated with numerous colorful coats of arms of officers and commanders of the Pontifical Army. The restoration, performed 100 years ago, revealed some amazing frescoes that apparently date back to the 9th century. The value of the chapel is inestimable, especially now, during the Jubilee Year of Hope, when millions of pilgrims from all over the world are once again making their way to St. Peter's tomb, just as hundreds and hundreds of years ago.